Lucrative oil and gas deposits sit beneath Mexico's Juarez Valley, southeast of El Paso and the Texas border. Residents say they're the reason property owners are being driven from their land. I'm Shelley Koffler, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Property owners in the Juarez Valley say oil and gas made their land so valuable, they're being threatened and attacked, forced to leave. Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Madelon traveled to the area to check out the claims. Here's the first part of his report.
Here's the allegation. People interviewed for this story claim they've been forced off their land, burned out of their homes, and that many others have been murdered. They live in a string of Mexican towns hugging the U.S. border to the southeast of El Paso, Texas. The region sits on top of oil and gas deposits, and that's why residents claim they've been forced out. One of those towns is Guadalupe, a few minutes from the U.S. border. Construction on a superhighway and a state-of-the-art border crossing's underway. According to Mexican census rolls, nearly 10,000 people lived here in 2005. The mayor, who declined to be interviewed, claimed in local media that this year only about 1,000 people remain. One man, who like others asked not to be identified, explained what's happened.
El gobierno manda gente para presionar a los dueños de las tierras. Vete de aquí, no te queremos aquí.
The state government sends people here to pressure landowners to get out of here, to say, go away, we don't want you here. He says wealthy buyers then show up to grab the vacant land.
Vienen los compradores, los que tienen dinero.
Buyers are coming because Mexico's state-owned oil company, Pemex, is exploring for oil and gas here. The region's a geological extension of the Permian Basin of Texas and New Mexico, the highest producing oil field in the United States, rich in shale deposits. Tony Payan's the director of Rice University's Mexico Center in Houston.
And obviously, this land is being reconsolidated in the hands of a few, and possibly many of these politicians will have interests in the shale development in the future and will likely get a hold of that land no matter what.
With oil and gas development and plans for pipelines, desert land that no one cared about is now valuable. Chihuahua's Secretary of Public Works told a Juarez newspaper in September that he won't reveal the exact routes for the new roads because the government doesn't want to fuel land speculation. I asked another person about that.
Pues es que siempre el poder y la lana, claro.
This is all about power and money, he replied. He alleged that bureaucrats and politicians are now in the real estate business, acting at the very least as middlemen to sell farmland to investors. Again, Tony Payan.
They are using, it is quite evident to me, that information for themselves in a way that they can position themselves as a political class to profit from this industry in the future. Oil, gas, and of course, the pipelines themselves.
Back in Guadalupe, physical evidence suggests that someone doesn't want people here. Burned houses, shattered glass, very few people on the street.
El Valle de Juárez es sin ley.
This valley is a lawless place, another man says. It's the sad truth.
Es la triste realidad.
Mexican authorities cited in media reports say at least 300 people have been killed in this one town since 2008. Mayors, police, city councilors, business owners, human rights activists. People are learning a hard lesson about real estate.
You know the rule, location, location, location.
Julian Cardona is a photographer from Juarez. He's watched a slow motion depopulation unfold here. He says residents tell him that authorities don't do anything.
Every time there was a killing, every time there was a burning house, the soldiers were a block away. They didn't stop the killers or the people burning the houses.
Pipeline companies north of the border in Texas are historically granted the right of eminent domain to seize private land because the transport of energy is deemed to be in the public's interest.
In the United States, it's a lawful eminent domain. In Mexico, it's outright violence.
That's El Paso lawyer Carlos Spector. He represents 250 former residents of the Juarez Valley, many from Guadalupe, now seeking asylum in the U.S.
Investors are getting very aggressive. All they have to do is get a list from the mayor of a small town who he's under their control as to who hasn't paid the taxes. And if they can match up who hasn't paid the taxes to where the gas and the freeway is coming, then you go after that property. It's very, very scientific.
People who remain in Guadalupe say that former neighbors who fled are anxious to sell their now abandoned land for cents on the dollar because they're too frightened to even contemplate coming back.
A former Mexican politician has his own story to tell. He claims the land grab has resulted in the deaths of some of his relatives. Lauren Madelon continues his report.
Martin Huermo is one of 250 former residents of the Mexican border town of Guadalupe, southeast of Juarez, Mexico, and El Paso, Texas, now seeking asylum in the U.S.
Varias amenazas, no una, varias.
I received several death threats, not just one, he says. Huermo was a city councilor in 2010. He'd opposed the mayor's resolution that would allow the Guadalupe government to expropriate land to sell to energy speculators. A few days before he entered the U.S., two women on the city council were killed. They'd opposed the same resolution. The year before, two of his brothers-in-law were killed.
Todas las familias del Valle Juárez sufrieron la pérdida de un ser querido para poder entender que tenían que irse del Valle Juárez.
Families in the Juarez Valley have lost loved ones, he says. It's a message saying they have to leave the valley.
Para poder beneficiar a unos cuantos y poder vender los predios.
To get people to leave, to benefit a few, and to be able to sell land, he says. Residents say violence rose in the Juarez Valley in 2010 after the murder of Josefina Reyes Salazar, killed on the outskirts of Ciudad Juarez. She'd led the Mexican side of a successful binational campaign to stop a nuclear waste dump in Sierra Blanca, Texas, just across from Guadalupe. And she'd spoken out about land displacement in the Juarez Valley. An art gallery worker from Ciudad Juarez, Gabriela Carballo, compares opposition to pipelines in Guadalupe to conflict in the U.S. over the proposed American Trans-Pecos pipeline. It would ferry natural gas from Texas into Mexico. There's intense opposition by some Texas landowners.
As a Mexican, I can say I care about the environment as much as anyone, any one of these people that are fighting the pipeline, the Trans-Pecos pipeline.
As for alleged land displacement in the name of energy in Chihuahua?
If we speak out against it, we run the risk of our really extremely corrupt government to murder us.
There's no way to verify such a claim, and Mexican officials are quick to refute them. Arturo Llamas is Chihuahua's pipeline regulator.
La violencia definitivamente es mínima ahorita la que existe en esas zonas. La violencia es mínima y a nadie se le está afectando en sus tierras con los tratos de los gasoductos.
Violence is minimal right now and no one's been affected by plans for pipelines, he says. Llamas is also the state's liaison with Mexico's federal energy agencies. Llamas says that energy development in northern Chihuahua is a boon to local residents that will mean lower electricity and gasoline costs.
Le van a ayudar no únicamente al estado, sino al país, ¿sí?
It will help the entire country, not just Chihuahua, he says. He says he's watching the Juarez Valley.
Vigilar que todo esto se cumpla, que se cumplan las leyes, que se cumplan los reglamentos.
To be sure that laws are obeyed and that everything that must be done is done properly, he says. But there are others beyond alleged victims who bear witness to a different reality. Mexican photographer Julian Cardona's cataloged the destruction of people's lives in the Juarez Valley.
I think now they are realizing the value of their land because now there are people buying their lands in the Juarez Valley. Violence is linked to displacement of their families.
He recalled a visit in June of Chihuahua Governor Cesar Duarte, who made a brief stop in Guadalupe.
The governor visited Guadalupe and the mayor ordered the empty buildings and houses along the main avenue to be painted in bright colors, glowing yellow, green, blue, pink. The fact that the house were painted in bright colors, it is like a smoke screen of what's really going on.
As for Martin Huermo, he says he'd have no issue with energy production or pipelines if they didn't involve, in his words, people being forced out. Then, unexpectedly, he says he does believe one of the government's claims.
El gobierno alega que ya la violencia bajó. Yo sí le creo, porque ya no hay habitantes a quien matar.
The government says violence is down in the Juarez Valley, he says. I believe it, because, he says, there are no more people left to kill. I'm Lorne Madelon in Guadalupe, Chihuahua.
Traveling north now to Dallas, where more than a dozen people have sued Sheriff Lupe Valdez and the county for their policy on holding immigrants. That comes after Governor Greg Abbott sent the sheriff a stern letter urging her to honor federal requests to detain immigrants. KERA's Stella Chavez has the story.
Valdez recently changed Dallas County's immigration detention policy. The county won't hold immigrants who've committed minor offenses for an additional 48 hours past their release date. That triggered Governor Greg Abbott's warning. He said the policy change posed a dangerous threat to Texans. But Fernando DeBovi, a Dallas immigration attorney, says what Valdez is doing is just mirroring federal guidelines that focus on the most dangerous criminals.
What Sheriff Lupe Valdez did is consistent with the policy outlined by the Department of Homeland Security back in 2014, when they prioritized which criminal unlawful immigrants they wanted to be held and placed under immigration detainers or held by the local police to be transferred to immigration.
When it comes to working with federal immigration officials, DeBovi says Valdez is less likely to detain people who are arrested for minor offenses like traffic stops or small amounts of marijuana. In his letter to Valdez, the governor said Dallas County had enacted a sanctuary city policy. DeBovi doesn't see it this way. He says the county and federal government have limited resources.
And they want to prioritize those resources in deporting from the United States criminals that are aggravated felons or people convicted of violent crimes.
Valdez is also getting blasted from immigrants who've spent time in Dallas County jails. On Monday, she and the county were sued by 16 people who claimed they were held in jail for months without being released on bond. Anthony Garza is one of the lawyers representing the plaintiffs.
We're not challenging Dallas County's practices writ large or how Dallas County works with ICE. Our lawsuit is about 16 very particular plaintiffs, and it's about how they were held pretrial without adequate opportunity for bond or bail.
Valdez issued a statement saying she can't discuss the issue because of the lawsuit.
That's Stella Chavez from public radio station KERA. Next on Fronteras, should Americans who live in other countries be called immigrants? And the significance of altars created for Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead.
This project is supposed to represent an understanding of how cultures celebrate death, to mourn the person but also celebrate their life.
Those stories after this. I'm Shelley Koffler, and this is Fronteras. There's a group of U.S. seniors who've moved to other countries to maximize their retirement savings. They usually call themselves expats, short for expatriates. So, aren't they also immigrants? KUT's Joy Diaz reports the answer to that question isn't so simple.
The question of how Americans define friends living in foreign lands and how Americans define people who've migrated to the U.S. has been on Sheila Croucher's mind for the last decade or so. Croucher teaches global and intercultural studies at Miami University of Ohio. She says a word as seemingly straightforward as immigrant is anything but straightforward.
I think it absolutely is politically charged, and I think it's racially charged, and I think it's charged in a number of ways.
In 2006, Croucher went to the colonial city of San Miguel de Allende in central Mexico to study a large community of Americans living there. She noticed something interesting. No matter what their legal status, none of them called themselves immigrants.
And then sometimes when I would push on the issue of terminology, I would be told, look, I'm just an American living in Mexico.
I don't refer to myself as an immigrant.
Russell Henson lives in San Miguel, the city Croucher studied years ago. The retired engineer and pilot now teaches aviation in Mexico.
So we are called temporary residents on our immigration status. But socially, we identify with our tribe.
Meaning they identify with other Americans living abroad, and they call themselves expats or expatriates. Professor Croucher says the term expat could carry a negative connotation, as in renouncing one's country, but it rarely does. On the contrary, the term often carries a certain cachet, and it's mostly used by Americans and Europeans living abroad.
There have been some recent studies, and I think an interesting article in The Guardian within the past year or so, about why do the Brits in southern Spain get to be expats when everybody else, going in the other direction, are immigrants.
Croucher says it may be because immigrants are often thought of as people who leave their homeland for economic reasons, but it clearly isn't that simple, since As it happens, most of the Americans she studied in San Miguel fit that profile.
They were absolutely moving for economic reasons and motivated by economic concerns, whether it was declining pensions in the United States or the rising cost of health care. So I think it would be politically interesting as a move for Mexican immigrants to say, okay, then we're expats too, and vice versa. I think it would be an important political move for the increasing numbers of U.S. and Canadian citizens going abroad to start calling themselves immigrants.
More American civilians now live abroad than ever before. Census data from host countries puts that number at 8 million. At the same time, patterns of migration into the United States are shifting. In the last 5 years, fewer arrivals say they have come for financial reasons. The Pew Research Center says almost half are highly educated. Juan Hua is one of them. He's a marketing expert from Mexico. His father is Chinese, his mother Mexican. He was educated in the U.S. and once lived in Germany. He now lives in Texas. And so how does he identify himself?
I don't know. It just depends on who's asking. But sometimes I just describe myself as a foodie or a happy person.
In terms of immigration, I don't think you can call yourself a foodie or a happy person.
Yeah. I don't think customs will take foodie I don't think there's a box for foodie yet.
Not yet, but Croucher believes the terminology is likely to change, in part because millennials like Hua are the most racially diverse, gender nonconforming generation so far, and their identities often don't fit into neat little check boxes on official forms. For them, immigrants and expats are just people. Now, if everything were so simple.
That was KUT's Joy Diaz reporting. This week, in many Latino neighborhoods, families are mocking death by displaying comical images of skeletons and skulls and decorating gravesites. They're also remembering departed loved ones with special ofrendas or altars. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan reports it's part of the Day of the Dead celebration.
Marissa Pelayo decorated a standing 4x3-foot cardboard placard altar with smiling photos, colorful papel picado skulls, and bright yellow marigolds. Her altar in Spanish, recalled the memories of her grandfather and Aunt Norma, who recently passed away.
She was like a second mom to me. And Leandro, he was my grandpa. He passed away when I was about to turn 4, and I was pretty close to him too.
Marissa is taking part in a celebration that is believed to have originated hundreds of years ago with the Aztecs and Mexico's indigenous people. The Day of the Dead, Día de los Muertos, includes decorations and celebrations that honor the dead, with comical depictions of skulls and skeletons, and personal items favored by the departed. Family members often decorate the graves of their loved ones with a favorite food or beverage.
November 2nd is a day that you never miss, that you would go out there and clean their resting place, their tombstones, and just dress them with flowers.
Centro Cultural Aztlan Executive Director Malena Gonzalez Cid says the holiday is infused with Christian and Catholic imagery. Her childhood Dia de los Muertos traditions stem from when she visited her grandmother in the small town of Allende, Mexico.
My grandmother did have an altar, an altarcito, which is a home altar that you had up all year round. And it usually was a table, and it was covered with pretty lace tablecloth. And you set up family pictures of dearly departed family members, saints, holy water, a cross.
And there were personal items, perhaps a guitar they played, their favorite shirt, or maybe even food.
I've seen women cook all day and cook that person's favorite meals, from enchiladas to mole to pozole. And those offerings are then offered on the table of the altar.
By the 1970s, some feared the Dia de los Muertos traditions might fade in South Texas. So the art director for Centro Cultural Aztlan invited Hispanic residents in San Antonio to display personal altars from their homes in the group's gallery. It's a tradition that's continued. Holy Cross High School Spanish teacher Alejandro Flores explains why he had his students make miniature altars this year that will be displayed for Monday night's celebration.
This project is supposed to represent an understanding of how cultures represent or celebrate death, to mourn the person but also celebrate their life.
Student Alejandra Gonzalez created an altar honoring two people close to her heart.
Doing my grandpa and his brother was kind of hard because as you're doing it, it brings back memories and stuff. And it just like, you want to make it as nice as possible because their memories and who they were deserve that.
She painted a tree from which pictures of them and implements of their lives sprung.
I chose to paint it because my grandpa was like really big with painting and he really loved art.
We've shed tears and we've cried together as a class. I know that I like to give my story about my mom because, you know, I tell them, you know, this is the woman that made me. If it weren't for her, I wouldn't be here because the role she played in my life.
Malena Gonzalez-Cid is happy that an interest in the old tradition is finding a new home in the young.
It grounds them in helping them understand what death is about and that we accept death as a very natural part of the cycle of life, that everything that begins ends at some point.
Marissa Pelayo says her generation is now part of carrying on that tradition.
Of course, I think I want to keep doing it like as long as I can. It has such significance, meaning to it. Like, I want to keep doing it for them and my grandchildren, great-grandchildren, however long I live to be, I want for them to do it.
And one day it may be her memory and life that's commemorated with an altar. In San Antonio, this is Jack Morgan.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Taranga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Shelley Koffler from Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.